Age is what you make it. You are never too old or wrinkly for a second or third act. Run at life head on. Go to bed in your makeup. Eat too much bread and butter pudding. And always fill your world with colour.
You'll have to excuse me as I'm just a bit overexcited. I've just interviewed a legend of the fashion world, a complete icon, the one and only Dame Zandra Rhodes, known for that dramatic, distinctive design and her love of colour. Zandra has been a leading figure in the British design world for, can you believe this, 6 decades. And it felt as though I was sitting with a kindred spirit because I suppose here was a woman. She's navigated every dip and turn of that roller coaster, professionally and personally, setbacks, loss, cancer, business going well, business not going well. But she's ready to face another day, makeup on, hair as pink as ever, and just, I don't know, just fabulous. She was fabulous. I'm in awe. So wherever you're listening, maybe you're walking, you're in the car, in the workshop, this conversation is going to inspire and motivate and ignite. And you might just want to dye your hair pink again, as I did after this episode. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Zandra, it's a dream to be sitting in front of you. As I develop my business and over the last 20 years, there are few women for me that represented not only being an icon, but everything that you represent actually means a lot to me. And I look up to you. So to be sitting in front of the woman right now, thank you for joining Conversations of Inspiration.
Well, thank you for asking me. And you look wonderful. So you've obviously dressed for the part.
Well, actually, this is how I actually dress. And so this is, there are a few people who turn up in colour. And colour actually has been a really great therapist for me.
Colour makes you feel happy.
Yeah. When you go out there, I think we're the few rather than the norm. And so actually to meet you, sitting with you, I feel like I've met a kindred spirit. And
it's good. So, except I'm in a warm woolly jumper today.
Well, pink, and we've got what brooch is that?
Oh, it's an Andrew Logan fried egg.
I was going to say, it's gorgeous. So yes, I'm going to take a picture, everyone, but I'm looking at a fried egg and a beautiful woman with pink hair. How's your day been so far? We're sitting in this amazing place, but I read when researching you that you're always someone who likes to be made up, and that your morning routine, I mean this, if I couldn't love you more, I'm just going to keep on saying this, your morning routine is washing off your makeup from the night before reapplying it again. Now, for me, that is just refreshing. It's different in this whole world where we've got retinols and serums and God knows what and TikTok this and TikTok that. Tell me, so the morning's an important part of your day?
Oh, the morning's important. I have my bath and then I wash around. If I'm really late, I wash around the makeup. If I'm doing okay, I wash off and then put it on. But otherwise, I just reapply on top.
Reapply on top. And has that always been the way?
And I never go out without makeup.
Never.
Never.
So that is your signature, who you are.
It's who I am. And it's the same if I was in bed, I'd still have the makeup on.
What was your... Sorry, I'm going practical here. Does it rub off on the pillow?
No, you can come down and have a look. I don't have any marks on my sheets. Of course, it'll probably start happening now, but I don't have any marks on my sheets. And then when I dye my hair, I put the
pink dye on. I put a plastic hat on and a black towel over my pillowcase, and I sleep that night with it on.
With that on, yeah. It's fantastic. You've got the signature style, and I'm going to get into so much about your life, but I just to ask these questions that people will be thinking about, and then I'm going to talk about your book as well. So we're going to cover so much, but your vibrant hair, big jewellery, beautiful colour clothes. As I just mentioned, expressing yourself through your style, almost like a window to your soul, potentially maybe an armor, I don't know, through your career or something that's made you feel strong. How has it played a part, not for you fashion designing, but almost for you personally?
I think as a designer, you represent your work. Like sometimes people say to me, would you wear someone else's clothes? And I say, I don't wear anyone else's clothes, because if I'm saying to people, oh, you should have a Zandra Rhodes, then if I'm not wearing a Zandra Rhodes, what am I advertising?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's my living. So you want people to say, oh, didn't know it could look so good, and it doesn't matter how old you are. Do you know what I mean? So that they can see that they can wear them.
It's interesting because over the years, talking to small businesses and mentoring them, and how often potentially people feel that they need to be separated out from their brand. You know, so almost, I mean, my company's called Holly & Co. I can't be more in my brand. And
exactly.
And yourself. What do you feel about that sort of, some people would say, am I giving too much? You know, it's all of me going into this company and it's a business. And actually I should have, you know, work-life balance and this separation. And I've got a feeling you might have a different take on that.
I don't separate myself from my work at all.
Yeah.
So actually, I mean, like I say, I go out in things that I've designed. Other things like my jewellery are designed by friends. Andrew Logan, I wear nearly all his jewellery, and he used to make it for all my shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd use it if I was doing a show of work that I was doing, needing them. So, I mean, I suppose I'm always representing my own image.
And what would you say to people listening about that idea of having to be separate, almost two separate things? Do you think there is merit in actually going all in and being the biggest brand ambassador to what you do and living and breathing it 24 hours a day?
I suppose it does depend on what sort of brand you do. So if you've got what I would call maybe a classic brand, then obviously, no one's going to notice if you're wearing the right bit of that
yes.
or not. Whereas if I'm representing an exotic Zandra Rhodes print on a Celia B dress, then, you know, they're going to see me coming. But I love it. And it makes, and I've been wearing the summer dresses with sweaters underneath, looking really bright at Christmas. It was lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. I try and help people embrace what they're doing, especially as most companies I deal with are creative. And I'm just almost like, you know, when you walk into a room, how are people going to remember you? What are they going to take? What's your aura like? How do you make people feel? But also, how do you represent what you do? And don't worry so much if it is who you are, your company. You know, it's a great thing, actually. You know, it makes you unforgettable, so to speak.
If you're designing something and you're saying, I really believe in this for my summer holidays, or I want to wear that for Christmas, if you're wearing it, people can see that you'd wear it for Christmas and you love it. And that's
and
all there
authentic.
Is.
And it's authentic.
And that's authentic and it's all there is to say about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to go back to the younger Zandra. Six decades you've been in this illustrious career, but I wanted to start where it all began, which is in Chatham in Kent, where you grew up with your sister Beverly. And I know you dedicated your book partially to her as well.
Yes.
And you were surrounded by your mother's sewing magazines. And your mum, Beatrice, she worked as a fitter in Paris before becoming a lecturer at the now University of Creative Arts. And so many of my guests I've been lucky enough to interview, you can see this golden thread, I call it, from childhood.
That's a lovely way of putting it.
Childhood to now, where these early passions, or someone was exploring something and then suddenly that's what they've ended up doing. You had a doll called Jacqueline who you dressed. Was it a creative home growing up, thanks to your mum?
Oh, my mother was, well, she always looked exotic. Like none of the other mothers, she wore lots of makeup She put in right in the first chapter, I talk about how she pinned her hair in a wonderful curl up in the front and she sprayed it silver. And then, of course, one time we were going up to London to do Christmas shopping and we're rushing around because we have to get the 6 o'clock train to London and she sprays her hair. And then we get on the bus and she says, My head does sting. And she sprayed herself with the fly killer instead of the hair setting lotion. So she had to live with it all day with this stinging head.
But what decade would that have been in that she was dressing in that way?
That would have been in the 50s.
So absolutely not what you would have seen
not
on an average...
Not typical of Chatham.
No, not typical of Chatham. How did it go down? Were you proud of her standing out?
When I look back, I'm very proud of her standing out. But when we used to have... She used to come for our school open days. She didn't look like any other mother. And I'd say, Mummy, you don't look like any other mother. You know, she'd be in wedged green crocodile shoes... And a very nice jacket, you know, all of which she'd made. So it was like Parisian fashion in Chatham, which some people at my school, some girls might not even have been to London, you know.
Yeah.
So it was...
Where did it come from? Have you traced back, going back further from your mum? Like, how did your mum have that to be so daring at a time where... It really wasn't the norm. I mean, now you can get away with basically anything.
When I think about it now, a girl from Chatham who then went to Paris to work as a fitter in Worth in Paris, she just went over and she always told me about this story because she'd go in and she'd say, yes, she could do the job. But just in case she couldn't, she'd go up to the head fitter and say, look, I'm new and I don't want to do it how you don't want it. You do a bit for me and show me how you want it done.
Clever.
And so that she obviously had a lot of nous, as they say, and really went over there all by herself to France. She couldn't speak French. I mean, it was amazing.
Extraordinary, actually, when you think about
it. And then
that.
In my childhood, she was always at her sewing machine, and it wasn't electric. It would have been a treadle in those days.
Yeah,
And then all these lovely French magazines and Queen magazine with all these exotic models on them. You know, so I had that to live with, even though it was in Chatham.
It's quite incredible, actually, isn't it, when someone blossoms. I mean, that's what she did. She blossomed out of... what wouldn't have been expected from her. I read you had more of a tricky relationship with your father, Albert, but actually when writing your memoir, you uncovered the truth about your grandmother's tragic death. But tell me about what the impact was of uncovering more about your father.
It was, in the end, when I was doing the book with Ella, we'd sit for whole days talking about things and it was very cathartic in a way because I'd never... My father was exactly like Elf Garnet in Death Do Us Part.
Right.
And I mean, I never wanted people to see him. Children are horrible snobs.
Yes,
you know,
they are.
So that it wasn't like you had a father that you thought people could respect. It was very, you know, they were so different.
Mm.
And I mean, they'd met ballroom dancing and he did look like Errol Flynn. And he, you know, he would have been very elegant. My mother could have made the most amazing ball gowns. So I suppose they had that in common, but not, he didn't then, I felt he should have then strived to have bettered himself. But I don't know. I think children are just snobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And tell me about the sort of, through your book, you uncovered more and more knowledge about your family.
Well, that was really my sister's grandchild who got into going to, Ancestry.
Yes.
So she was delving into all these things and finding out about this terrible murder because I was never told about that. I just knew that she was a prostitute.
This is your father's mother, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, your father's mother who was thought that was murdered.
That was murdered in the streets.
Yes, in the streets, murdered.
It was never talked about.
Yeah.
So it was only really when doing this book that it all came to light, the reality of the whole thing.
Which actually she was murdered by her
Well, one of her lovers. That was a tenant in the building, you know. But I suppose in a small town like Chatham, it would have been really big publicity at that time.
Big news. You sort of forget also how much in those days things weren't, I mean, big news, but almost maybe not spoken about, why it wasn't told to you what the truth
exactly.
is. I mean, I think as we go back, I know from personal experience, you know, just so much wasn't spoken about. The war, you know, you keep going through and people kept things to themselves.
Yes.
We speak a lot more now, don't we, about our lives, I suppose.
Yes, you know, so I mean, it's just sort of, and I don't even know if my father even knew if I knew. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
So it was all sort of very strange.
So going from there, you were quite academic at school when you left and you went to the Medway Royal College of Art and then to the Royal College of Art.
Yes.
It was early 60s. I read that David Hockney was there. You were inspired by Warhol and everything was happening. It must have been, I would love to go there for 1 week, to experience what that must have been like. What was that time like for you?
We were in the brand new building by the Albert Hall.
Yeah.
So it's a very grand building. We were the first group of students in there, and then you'd glimpse David Hockney, who was a third year. I was only a first year. And all these.
Was he big stuff then?
Within my first year, he was really very famous by then. He'd started to have his work up and everything, you know what I mean? And he dyed his hair blonde. I mean, and in those days, that was really way out.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was like, it was a fantastic time to be at the Royal College.
Yeah, amazing. And did you have a feeling, I mean, you can do it in hindsight, can't you? But did you have a feeling then this might be not normal?
It just felt very electric. We had a whole group of students and everyone worked really hard. Do you know what I mean? It was the time when it was a college ball at the end of the year. It was the Beatles. We were dancing to people who could play the Beatles songs. And I had thick black. I didn't make myself up like this then, but I had still had black hair. And then I had great big false eyelashes. And the head of the college called me Death on the Roads.
Was that endearing? Was that?
You know, I mean, I don't know why, but I mean, he remembered my false eyelashes.
You remembered your false eyelashes. And you worked 6 days a week. You just were, I read that you were there, you know, 6 days a week, closed on a Sunday in those days, but you basically more or less lived there,
I was there nearly all the time, but it was my life then. It was lovely. I lived in South Kensington and I just walked to college. And then at night, we could go to the college bar. And I can always remember the guys were always playing darts.
Yeah.
But there was also a wonderful film. You could see, they showed really wonderful classic old films like Eisenstein and things.
Yeah.
So it was an inspirational time.
Yeah. Yeah.
My hands were usually bright green because still in those days, I was a textile designer.
Mm.
And I started to be interested. When I first went, textiles were wallpapers and wonderful fabrics hanging down. And I was taken up to Manchester to see what Manchester was like. And it was raining and grey. And then I got into doing textile designs and getting in touch with the dress school with Janie mm-hmm. Ironside. And I was doing bright prints that were like flags because it was flags and Andy Warhol type things. So I went between the Royal College students department. I printed garments, some of which were fabrics, which were used by Ossie Clark. You know, so I really got into wanting to do dress fabrics.
Yeah.
And then when I left Royal College and they, as one of their prize students, they said, we'll take you on a trip up to Manchester. And I showed them my work all carefully there and they'd look at it and then they'd laugh and they'd show me, look at this fabric. And it was a horrible texture. We sold a million yards of this. Right. I mean, they weren't going to buy any of mine. So the college then said, well, why don't you go directly to Carnaby Street? So I went to Carnaby Street to two girls called Marion Fole and Sally Tuffin, who were making very trendy dresses. And I did prints with stars and prints with very exotic swirls of fabric. And then insisted as we did it that my name was always quoted if it was done in in a magazine. So I really, people got to know me for doing those fabrics.
Yeah.
So for Fole and Tuffin. And then after 2 years, they said, oh, they were going on to some other theme and they didn't need me anymore. And then I met Sylvia Ayton while I was teaching 2 days a week. And Sylvia and I formed a little company called Sylvia Ayton and Zandra Rhodes. And we made dresses and we made some clothes for Vanessa Redgrave. And she ended up giving a deposit for us to open a shop in the Fulham Road, in the wrong part of Fulham Road.
But never mind.
But we had Joe Cocker to open it playing.
Wow.
And
wow.
A very exotic gala with her gorgeous auburn hair. So we opened it with a great big bang. And then it closed with a bang a year later.
Because of where it was located?
Location, and we were making the dresses hand to mouth. I was teaching 2 days a week, and so was Sylvia. I'd rush to my studio and print the fabric for the clothes, and you know, and then it would go out just to a small dressmaker. So it was very hand to mouth. So that ended, and Sylvia got a job as head designer for Wallis, which she did for years beautifully, and I was thinking, well, I don't want to teach. And so English Vogue, I made some clothes. I made some caftans and some printed yellow felt coats. And I had a close friend who was a librarian who went to Royal College, and he showed me how to make patterns. Mm. So I made the patterns and cut the things out, and then I got a machinist to make them. And then through English Vogue, they gave me a letter of introduction to Deanna Vreeland in New York. And it really all happened from there.
And it happened from there. My goodness. When that person was telling you about this grey fabric that you just definitely didn't want anything to do with, and you had your vision, basically, in fabrics, what was it that you believe you capture that you knew then? You know, you knew then that actually the majority of people were going to reject you from that sort of course because that was what happens and that's what sells and that's what's got the margin. But you decided quite young, you know, this pattern, this bright, you said, I was reading about your knitted landscape scarf that you talk about in your book. And you said, my first choice is always the bright colourway. What is it about pattern and colour that you thought, even if it isn't the majority's cup of tea, I'm still going to do it?
I sometimes don't understand. I mean, maybe there are things in us that make you do something regardless of anything else, and you think this is going to work. And I don't know, it was a time of pop art, and it was friends were encouraging. Do you know what I mean? So it was just a time when it felt right to do all those things.
Yeah, and maybe that's what it takes, that it feels right for you. And that actually that's how everything starts. You know, everything that we might think, oh, that's not, you know, that goes against the grain of that time. We need the beacons like yourself to introduce it into society.
I mean, maybe that's what it is. You know, like sometimes when, I mean, I try out makeups and I think, I don't know, one of my boyfriends, I think there's a comment in the book where, you know, he thought I looked a bit extreme, you know, but I never thought about it. I just did it. And that was it.
Yeah.
It wasn't, is it all right to go out looking like this?
Yeah. So if women, we can tend to ask permission or need validation from boyfriends, people around us. Did you really feel like your mum in a way? Now you look back, do you feel like you've never needed to be similar or have permission or the comment of him saying you're extreme, did that bother you?
It didn't. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I've just sort of do it and go out. And then it's only sometimes when you realise people look in a certain way that you do something different, but it comes naturally to decide to do it that way.
Yeah, and it's never bothered you to stand out.
Oh, no, that doesn't. I mean, it was funny. I had a letter from a long while ago now, a girl who was at school with me. She said, oh, congratulations on how's your career gone. I'm really sorry that we always used to laugh at you on the bus. Well, I must have the thickest skin in the world because I didn't know they were laughing at me on the bus. So
that's so good. That's so good. You know,
so it's maybe just the thick skin.
Maybe it's the thick skin. That's the thing. We've got to we've got to thicken up if anyone out there is being bothered. I remember speaking to Jenny Peckham about her beautiful gowns, and we were talking about the power of emotionally connecting to your customer, and that you want to look good in your clothes, but actually it's the transformation that can happen. And I know I can speak from personal experience, you know, growing my companies, and there was a certain point where I feel like I became a cookie cutter of what people were expecting I needed to become, almost to grow up and become a businesswoman. Yeah. You know, I needed to wear this and this is what you do. And I need to look basically more like a man, basic. I just needed to fit in a way.
And you didn't feel at home until you changed that.
I would say I didn't until, you know, and I had these moments in my career where it all came crashing down. And it was through rising from those ashes that my colour came back, literally my colour came back. And I feel that transformation of how I wear colour every day, or that's how I'm also known, healed me. I said when we started, it was like therapy for me. And it really has had a profound effect.
You put your clothes on, you felt right, and then you
could
you,
be
your
right.
Job, you could yes. be right and attempt your job how you want to do it.
Attempt to be who I want to be, I think. Or it gave me the confidence for a bit more of Holly to come out. I don't know. Was it a vessel or a feeling? Do you think that that's the power of design in a way, or certainly fashion design, that people can sort of, like a cape, I suppose, almost become something?
I think we all have a certain suit of armour that we go by. Right. And it's like we put that suit of armour on and we know how we feel and we know that it keeps us going.
Yeah.
When there are times, I mean, for example, I always make sure I'm fully made up and looking okay, even if I'm putting out the garbage, because, you know, I remember times when you put out the garbage and then you look up across the road and there's someone taking a photograph and you think,
Hang on a minute.
I've got to always, as what we do, we represent ourselves so that people never feel let down nowadays if they see you.
I was reading about the power of fashion in something, and I didn't know this, but in the Second World War, when fashion was scarce, lipstick was still sold, and that Churchill kept lipstick off the ration list because it symbolised sort of, I don't know,
people being able to feel better.
And how women felt better with it. So yes. It wasn't on the ration list.
I love that.
So I'm going to come back to your story. You were one of the designers, as we all know, who put London at the forefront of international fashion in the 70s, winning so many accolades for your work. And with your pink hair and your electric designs, you were known as the Princess of Punk. So you've actually had quite a few names. What's the other one? Death on the Road.
No. Oh, Death on the Rose. Was from the head of the Royal College,
Princess
Robin Darling.
We've got another one here. And you were just dressing different types of people. And then you started designing clothes for Diana, Princess of Wales. And you weren't the most conservative, as we can tell. Did that surprise you that royalty came your way? And because, you know, undoubtedly she was an icon of that time, but you wouldn't have put two and two together.
What tends to happen when you're summing up my life is I started off as a textile designer, so my clothes are usually very involved in being patterned.
Yeah.
So when I first went to America with the printed flowing printed chiffons and the gorgeous printed evening coats that Diana Vreeland put on Natalie Wood in Vogue, that was one look. Then in the middle, I thought, oh, I should give it a rapid change, and I invented the conceptual chic punk look. And we did the punk dresses with the beaded safety pins and chains. And my partner, Anne Knight, in my shop in Mayfair said, look, if you're going to do something so extreme, we're going to fill the window with it to be convincing. We filled the window to be convincing with removing the flowing chiffon dresses. put it in the window, and for two weeks we didn't sell anything.
Right.
It went. We put it, that went downstairs into the basement. Now, they're now collector's items because when Harold Coda retired from the Met in New York, the Metropolitan Museum, the one thing he wanted in all the world was my white punk wedding dress. But I reckon I only ever sold three punk outfits in the whole of my life. I have them as a collection, and then there's one set in Philadelphia, and then there's different rare sets across the world. But I went back to the chiffon dresses.
You're right.
So basically, it's the chiffon dresses.
And you almost meaning like people sort of pick these, the good bits of the stories, that they piece together the overnight success type thing. And really here we're talking about, there were some hiccups along the way. It wasn't quite perfect. Well, spring is here. There's hope in the air, and I'm thrilled to be back with a brand new series of Conversations of Inspiration. If you're a new listener, a big hello from me and a warm welcome. And if you've been part of this community for many years, then welcome back. At Holly & Co, we're not just a small business marketplace, we're a small business marketplace with a purpose. It's our mission to create a more thoughtful way for people to shop, live and work, so that we're all better able to show our love for others as well as the world that we live in, and spend our 29,000 days on this planet doing something worthwhile. From unique handmade gifts for every possible life moment, to homeware made to last, everything we sell is carefully curated and supports a UK artist or maker. We also share all kinds of ideas to help you live creatively and all the tools and confidence you need to start a business if you want to. And not just a good business, but a business that does good. To find out more, just visit holly.co or sign up to our emails. For now, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. So how did it come about that you were there with Diana? And, I mean, was that a moment for you?
Well, I had a beautiful chic shop in Mayfair for 15 years, from the mid-60s into the whole of the 70s and nearly the end of the 80s.
Right, wow.
So where I had my wonderful chiffon clothes, of which, for example, Diana Ross came in and bought a whole outfit.
Yes.
And Princess Diana had six outfits.
Right.
But then she'd come in and she'd fit something. Then I'd go in my mini to the palace and I'd fit her in her version, because she might have tried on the off-shoulder black dress, but it became an off-shoulder pink dress and all the points were edged with pearls and it was printed in lovely white pigment. It was gorgeous. So I was thrilled that she had like all these dresses of mine.
Yeah. And I read that you said that she was very shy, a very, very nice woman, but a shy woman.
She was very shy. She bit her nails a little bit and she was always quite gorgeous. You know, you'd go in and you'd curtsy and you'd go in and try the dress on her. And then I was lucky enough to go to that grand sale when she divorced Charles, and she had the grand sale at Christie's in New York.
I mean,
the room was breathless as these amazing sales took place for thousands of dollars that people bought.
Amazing.
So it really was an electric time.
Gosh, incredible. Am I wrong or right that you would quite like to dress, you know, when you think about dressing someone now, wrong or right that you have said Beyoncé would be someone that you would like to dress?
Oh, I'd love to do clothes for all those different ones, you know. So you could definitely, Lady Gaga. I mean, I could.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I
that
could
is
do
a
an
match made in heaven.
Dress.
That is surely that can happen, no?
Well, it might. May might be listening to this program. Who knows?
You know what? Funny you should say that. when you say something on this podcast, it happens. So this is the ask that
beware
we're putting out.
Beware what you say, or yeah, it might just happen.
Lady Gaga, I know you're a regular listener here, but I have someone who's very happy to dress you. So if it just let me know and I can just hook you up. So in 2003, you founded the Fashion and Textile Museum in London. And yes. What a space this is. It was a self-funded project and you actually sold your home to finance it. And I have to say, it's why you did it. It's a legacy. It's you in a building, if that could even happen. Tell me about the experience of founding the museum and why you felt that you needed to do it. Because again, a little bit of like you being your brand, and sort of when I go out there and I talk to businesses, almost selling your home to then create the museum that you knew you wanted to create for your legacy, it's almost part of the same bubble. You're going all in. You know, it's all about the whole of you rather than two parts.
In life, whoever knows the real truth? One's career, one minute with a career, you're up here, and the next minute you've dived down to the bottom. So one minute people are adoring a Sandro chiffon dress, and then another time they're being a fantastic Thierry Mugler suit.
Yes.
So
the roller coaster.
I always saved all my favourites from every collection.
Right.
And my great friend Andrew Logan lived around the corner from here, near, because this is where the Shard is. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, Sandra, this was in the early 90s. He said, Sandra, there's a warehouse going and you've always wanted to do a museum. I think you should get it. And I said, what do you think I am? Made of money? And I worked out that I could sell my house in Bayswater and it would pay for the building.
My gosh.
So it paid for the building because they hadn't built the Shard.
Right, yes.
It paid for the building. So I moved everything into this warehouse and lived in virtual squalor for about 4 or 5 years in the offices above the warehouse. And first of all, I flew Ricardo Legarreta, the famous Mexican architect, to London on my mileage, first class on my mileage tickets. And I said, I got a group of very big architects together and said, look, this is an up-and-coming area and you've never done something in Europe. And so he designed it for me and his first building in Europe. And then, of course, I thought the government would give me a grant. I thought I'd get a grant for doing this.
Well, wouldn't you think?
Oh, well, you would think,
yeah,
but
you
I
would
didn't.
Think. No.
So my boyfriend, who had great initiative, who happened, by the way, to be the president of Warner Brothers Cinemas, but he said to me, well, let's rethink it. Let's think, get another local architect to come over here and work with your architect, and we'll build as many flats on the top as we can, which was actually nine.
Nine, yes.
So we built nine apartments above the build, or designed it that way.
Yep.
And then we pre-sold the apartments, and that paid for
the
converting the building into both the museum and the flats. So then I had one flat, which is now going to be the Sandro's Foundation. So that's what happened.
That's what happened. And why did you have that vision for the museum? What was it that...
Well,
do you feel like it's not represented in terms of... I know you talk a lot about, you know, we celebrate artists, but actually design, pattern, fashion is art and... There isn't a celebration.
I don't think people appreciate the worth of textile designers. Mm. You know, if you see a fantastic Chanel suit by Karl Lagerfeld, an invisible weaver made that incredible weave.
Yeah.
And there's not enough credit given to the people who create the textiles. And since that's really my job, I felt the museum, we've often now done shows just of fabulous textile designers who work in the background and you don't hear anything of them. Like, well, Audrey Levy, who did all the wonderful prints for the Festival of Britain. So she's in the 50s. Then you've got Pat Albeck, who I always used to go to when I needed new people to come and work in my studio, because she always trained them perfectly. And she did all of the wonderful, when you go to a country house, she did all the tea towels and things that you buy in those country houses. So, there are wonderful textile designers that you don't know of.
Yeah.
That are really such a wonderful influence.
You've been able to shine a light on. What have you thought over the decades that you've been working in fashion about fashion, I suppose? You know, we've had the minimalists in the 90s, rise of fast fashion. Post-pandemic, we saw the sort of lounge leisure wear. I remember everyone saying during COVID, maybe roaring 20s were going to come, you know, sort of glamour come back and all that, because we were all, I don't know, in pyjamas for years. What do you think about the sort of what you've seen, and potentially do you have a view about the future of fashion?
I do think, unfortunately, that we've shot ourselves in the foot separating from Europe.
Yeah.
I hope long term we will go back to be joined to Europe. And at the moment, we're not getting the Europeans. Mm-hmm. And so many, and when you think of really in Paris, a lot of the names that you quote, like Alexander McQueen, where did he come from? London. John Galliano, actually, he trained in London, although he is from Gibraltar. But do you know what I mean? That the English designers seem to come out with great statements. I hope our talent is opened to Europe a bit more again.
And fast fashion, I mean, do you look what's happening, and I think I'm not wrong in saying this, I might get the timing wrong, I think it's something like there is a Everest in size mountain of wasted fashion every month, the size of Everest, and that is one of our number one polluters of the planet. And is that really even fashion? It's clothing, I suppose.
I think we've got to rethink. I mean, I think we've got to see that we can't put something new on all the time. After all, if you have something that you really treasure, like your beautiful dress you've got on today, you're not going to throw it out.
Oh, never.
I think more and more people are becoming geared to the fact that they could buy. I mean, I'd love it if I see someone saying, I bought your dress secondhand and I'm wearing it now and it's staying alive.
Yeah,
I don't really mind.
Absolutely.
I think it's just a compliment. And I think I wish more people, because you and I were talking earlier, would mind if they stand out in the tube. You know, I get on the tube and I count, and there's only one person in a light blue jumper.
I know. Daring.
Would you see anything pink or red? No.
I know.
Well, maybe me. But do you know what I mean? And you're thinking, why are they convinced that if they wear black, it's going to make you feel happy?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I wanted to speak to you a little bit about your last 5 years, because I know in 2019 that you lost your partner, Salah, and you described him as the greatest love of your life. You mentioned him as your boyfriend, you're the president of Warner Brothers, and he was a Hollywood legend in his own.
And he was a workaholic and didn't notice that I was.
How great is that? But firstly, I wanted to say I'm very sorry for your loss, and I can imagine it must have been incredibly painful losing a rock in your life. I also read that, as you said, that you are a self-confessed workaholic, and that you threw yourself, navigating that time, back into your passion, your life, your work. We all grieve differently. And I speak about this just because right now I'm dealing with a number of businesses that I know all going through grief, or going to be going through grief. And we talk about using our businesses as a life raft. It's something that is our nest as we go through something that is unknown. Did it help you to do that?
Oh, if I hadn't had my work, it would have been incredibly difficult. So that, I mean, I had had my work. In fact, I did a fantastic collection for IKEA at that time, with rugs and vases and silk and screens, you know. So, I mean, I had a wonderful time. And then I made sure that through my friend Andrew Logan, I did all the frames of my boyfriend, you see. There he is.
Yes.
He was 92 there. So he gallops up my walls as 92 and 93 and everything.
Yes, 94,
and 96. And so they all followed me to here in London. So I try and surround myself with memories,
yes,
as well as positives going forward.
He sounds like a remarkable man. You've mentioned him. And what I loved is reading how he encouraged you to develop the museum. He helped you to... do you know what I mean? He was cheerleading you to realise who you are. And I think so often we can have, I don't know, for cases of people being worried about us, or, you know, they try and slightly protect you or clip the wings, or they don't want to rain on the parade. They don't mean it, but a lot of people will say, oh, I think that's far too risky, or I don't want you to be doing that. And it can cause real, because we look for, don't we? We look slightly for that encouragement from,
yes,
the people nearest us. And again, I'm talking for people I'm helping at the moment. Mm. When you have that naysayer near you, that energy, it rubs off.
Oh, and it doesn't help to have... He was encouraging because he was always getting on with his work, anything. I think his former marriage had definitely failed because he was always working, you know. I later met his poor wife, and she obviously would have made dinner and said, are you coming home for dinner tonight? And then he'd phone up and say, I'm terribly sorry, I'm still in a meeting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you had a different world with him, but he was very supportive of who you wanted to be as a person.
Yes. And I think I ended up, for example, we entertained a group of bankers, and I'd be doing a dinner for 200 on our terrace, and I'd decorate it all Zander Rhodes style. So he had interesting tables with things on them and everything like that, you know. So I was entertainment in chief. So that was all right.
And then less than a year later, at the start of lockdown, you were diagnosed with cancer and given just 6 months to live. But instead of giving up, you did something extraordinary. And the diagnosis must have been a shock. But talk to me about deciding to form the Zandra Rhodes Foundation. I mean, that was a very heavy period of time in your life.
What I don't understand is that it didn't put me into any sort of panic. I just said, well, you're not to tell anyone. I only told about three friends.
Right.
I said, I don't want anyone to know. And then I formed the Zandra Rhodes Foundation, and then to make sure that my legacy would go into made for the future.
Yep.
So that, and then I started to look at how many clothes I'd hidden away over the past 40 years. And I'd got 6,000 garments that were all hidden in boxes.
Oh, my God.
All over the building.
Yes.
Behind
covered,
that large cloth over there.
Now covered in a large cloth. That's a good
That's
way of
it.
Covering.
Well, now we've been working out. It's been very exciting because, for example, I did a whole collection based on the rock, Uralu, in the centre of Australia with the wonderful grass. And I did some beautiful dresses, that one-sided dresses, and that Lauren Bacall and Jackie Kennedy had. Mm. So I made sure that I donated both the lengths of fabric and the garments to both the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney and the NGV, National Gallery of Victoria, in Melbourne. So I flew over and donated those, and then I went to New York, and they've got the Manhattan series that I did of the beaded dresses of Manhattan. So I'm gradually going to different places that have inspired me, keeping a core collection for here.
Yep.
A wonderful collection that Kerry Taylor, the world's top person who sells clothes, is going to put up on sale, and then various exhibitions we're doing. So it's been very exciting.
So you weren't panicked by the word cancer. How has it related to your life? How have you navigated this? Has it given you a new lease for life in a way?
I think it's given me... they first of all said you have 6 months.
Yes. Yes, sorry.
So
can we go back
bit? I thought, well, in that case, I've got to pull my life together. I've got to work out what I'm doing with things because they've got to go somewhere.
So then, very practical almost response.
I have not got a clue why I had that attitude. Do you know what I mean? So I had the treatment, and then the doctor said, well, in actual fact, we've managed, the growth has disappeared. And so I go in now every 6 weeks where they put something in me. I don't know what it is, but I'm still here. Right. And my hair didn't. Oh, and then my own doctor, who was on a call, you know, at the telephone.
A Zoom call.
He said, there's a question you haven't asked. And I said, well, I can't think of what question I haven't asked. He said, well, will you lose your hair? So I said, oh, that's not a worry. I've got about 20 coloured wigs. I can be green, turquoise.
They're just in a box somewhere.
They're in a box.
I found them.
And not being used. So I can easily use those if I need them.
Each week at this point, I hand over to our partners at Royal Mail. And for any founder listening, I wanted to make sure you knew about the full range of drop-off options that will make your busy life even easier. Royal Mail have over 130,000 drop-off points for your parcels. This includes parcel shops such as Collect Plus stores. These parcel shops operate 7 days a week until late and are an easy and convenient way to drop off parcels and returns. Royal Mail also have parcel lockers available with over 1,500 nationwide and growing. If you have a smaller parcel, you can also use your local postbox, so there's a drop-off point just around the corner. The Royal Mail app lets you scan your parcel's barcode to generate a proof of posting when you drop them off. So why not buy your postage online and choose the drop-off options that suits you and let Royal Mail do the rest? Did you find that actually the process of getting that diagnosis, the going back over your archives, the going through, has actually been quite a cathartic process for
you? It was definitely cathartic. It made me have to work out what I should do. And then, well, I didn't even know I'd put that many garments to one side.
You knew it was a lot, though, didn't you?
I knew it was quite a lot.
You would have been squirreling away.
But I'd never catalogued it.
No.
I just put, at the end of each season, if they didn't sell, my wonderful friend David Sassoon, who's been an inspiration for the whole of my life, he said he never had any, because he said I sold them at the end of each season, whereas I go, oh, it's a good one. I better keep that one. I never know. I might not get inspired again. I'll keep that dress.
This might be my last.
This might be the last. So that's the point, you know. And so I do have a record of all those things, so that
incredible.
One, they can, for some of the money that we sell them for, can go into the foundation.
Yeah.
Some then, I'm like I say, I'm trying to find them homes in the best museums where I feel there's a link. There are some wonderful museums in the north of this country, you know, the Platt and the Whitworth and all sorts of different museums that I could give one or two here and there, so students can have a chance to see what this country's given me.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so that's what we're really in the middle of doing. And the
how
V&A,
exciting.
I've given the V&A, because as I think the V&A is one of the top museums in the in the world, they've given us their wish list. So we now have to find the things and see what we can spare and work out, you know, because different museums, it's quite interesting, have got different things that they want. Like the Los Angeles County Museum didn't want any clothes because they've got about 30 of my clothes. But I found them lengths of fabric so that they can show that behind the dress.
Oh, yeah.
And show the dress was made from that fabric, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I mean,
we're doing
incredible.
All those things. So it's been.
How incredible that that's in your, I'm not saying daily conversations, but this is just, you know, one talking about the museums that are going to house your creativity.
It's wonderful. I mean, what would they like, you know? And then the V&A particularly wanted the slash silk because my Elizabethan collection was influenced by that, so they can maybe show a piece of my slash silk, you know what I mean, to go with things.
Tell me about the why, and was it all what we've just spoken to came into writing this book? Because I know I've touched on it during the podcast. It's called rather aptly Iconic, My Life in Fashion in 50 Objects, and it's an autobiography of your life told through 50 chosen objects that have defined your life. Did all of that, those 5 years, did that make you feel like, okay, this is the time, this is the time to write?
Well, Ella said to me, Sandra, have you ever thought of doing something? And in fact, like I say, it turned out to be cathartic, but there were all sorts of things I didn't even talk about. Mm. You know, I lived with Alex for 13 years from leaving Royal College, where we built this table together.
Wow.
And I still got it, yes. You know, and then we had to get together and I re-met some of these people that I hadn't met for 40 years. So it was a wonderful adventure.
Yeah.
You know, and going into some of those things and talking about them when they were things that I hadn't been able to face, different parts of my life that I felt I hadn't lived properly or whatever. Mm. So it became an adventure.
It is. It's an amazing. I mean, I've started reading it. I've spoken to people who have read it. And I'm enjoying it thoroughly.
Oh, good.
Because it's again, as I started this podcast, you are, of course, you're an icon. And I'm so privileged to be sitting here. But as a woman in business, a woman who's also trying to make her mark, we don't have many people to hold on to. You know, we don't have the inspiration to hold on to. There's very few people. And and so it really, really comes through why, I don't know. Anyway,
it was an amazing adventure to pick up the different things and think of different things in your life that you'd... That you know, the New York in the 70s before everyone started to die, the adventures one had gone through. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And it was definitely an adventure for me to have this information pulled out about me.
Yes. Yeah. A treasure trove, I can imagine. We're coming to the end of the podcast, but before I ask you the questions that people know I ask my guests, I wanted to understand, as a woman, what would you say to other women who are creative, who are tackling what life throws at them? And you know, we get a lot thrown at us. And what people are navigating today, what would some advice be specifically to women?
I think more than ever, not to give up, to try and, if you're lucky, have other close women friends that can help guide you and help you be strong. Mm. Because I think more than ever, I think it's difficult for women.
Mm.
I don't think things are always there, but I suppose we have to hold our own. And if you think of people that you remember, you always remember women that have stood out and do wonderful things. And it probably wasn't easy.
Yeah.
Like Frida Kahlo.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean, Florence Nightingale, you know, they must have had a fight on their hands all the time to prove it. And for some reason, I think it's probably still just as difficult. But I'm lucky that I was born with a thick skin. My mother was probably very, very encouraging, and I'm probably the result of her ambition. Mm. I didn't know it at that time. But I mean, I was always, I think, pushed forward and always encouraged. But I never knew that that was the situation. When I once said to my mother, oh, you'd have let me leave school at 15, wouldn't you? And she said, I wouldn't really, but you didn't end up doing that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I think
she was
always a woman. She'd never say you shouldn't do something.
Yeah.
Or she never said, if I finished with a boyfriend, she said, oh, I never liked him. I wouldn't ever have known that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Because in fact, her parents had been very, very against my father. And I think she'd married him because it was the fight to stand up for him too.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So
She never put barriers,
restrictions in. But then, I mean, summing it up, I've always thought that as a child, I was just a boring, hard worker. You know what I mean? I didn't mind school uniform because I could dress up afterwards. Do you know what I mean?
But no one would have thought that. Would have said who you were. Do you remember the rebellious girl with the different coloured hair in the
side?
Not when you were at school. We're coming towards the end of this podcast. I could sit and speak to you forever. And thank you so much.
You make it so easy.
Oh, well, bless you. Thank you so much. You have just... Tell me, I always summarise this journey, and I think you've even alluded to it, that it's like a roller coaster. The ups and downs when everyone wants Zandra, and then down and, you know, because everyone wants something else. What would you say on the Zandra roller coaster? Obviously, your roller coaster would look like no one else's. But in that cart, when it's at its lowest point, what would you say has been your lowest moment?
Well, probably when my business failed in the early 90s and we had to sort of get rid of staff. But on the other hand, I'd have never given up. I always made sure that I present the right face to the world, that you don't give up and you hope that you cling on to your best staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the people around you are always the ones that you need to rely on as well.
Has that been always, through your business, something you know to be true? It's those people who make a business or make a brand.
I think it's people and friendships, people that don't give up on you, people that believe in you. Mm. You know, there's been wonderful people believing in me, like Adele Rootstein, who made the world's top mannequins. They're still the best in the world, but she died, you know what I mean? But, you know, I think you must always treasure your friends who can give you advice and guide you through times that aren't very good.
And wind in your pink hair, you're on the roller coaster and you're on the up. What's one of the, I can't even begin to think
Mark,
you can
pick
one. Mark,
you're looking at me when I really should have given it an overhaul.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that I was doing a podcast and I didn't re-dye it, so it looks frightfully pale.
To anyone else, just so you know, it's absolutely bright pink. So it's pale to Zandra. What would be a moment that you would say could be one of the highest highs?
Probably at the very beginning of my career when Deanna Vreeland raved about my things in American Vogue and phoned up Henry Bendel, the top boutique in New York, and said, you've got to have these things, and then sent me round there and they ordered my clothes so that I was selling to the top people in New York and who were going to wear my clothes. I mean, I find it amazing that I go over there and I've got my high white Bieber boots on. I've got my headscarf. I still had brown hair, but my hippie headscarf and pink curls drawn on my face and blouson silk trousers and a flowing chiffon top. And they welcome me with open arms. I mean, when I think back, it must have been some sort of crack in the universe that...
Yes, you
said,
slipped
this
in.
I slipped in accidentally.
Yeah,
and
wow.
And it founded my career for me.
Wow, that moment. Unbelievable. Zandra, we're coming to the end. You've been so kind with your time today, with your energy, with your eyes and your smile. I've asked you to put some thoughts to your younger self down, and I was going to, if that's okay with you, hand over to you.
Oh, I don't know. That's risky. gosh, some thoughts of what that about my young, what I would say to someone.
Yeah, so it's basically, what would you say to your younger self?
Don't waste any of your life because it won't come back. So you've got to use it all to the best of your ability. Friends are important because they're life's double cream. When it comes to love, find an equal and don't settle until you do. Of course, you might have to go through a few. You don't always know what you need in a partner until they arrive. Finding the right person is luck. This is from my book. But for God's sake, follow it when it falls in your door. If it's right, you won't need to sacrifice any part of who you are for it to blossom. Age is what you make it. You are never too old or wrinkly for a second or third act. Run at life head on. Go to bed in your makeup, eat too much bread and butter pudding, and always fill your world with colour.
Brilliant. I mean, I can't even believe I've just sat there with you reading that. Thank you so, so much. Creative energy, unbelievable human being, complete icon, as your book says, and one of the greatest moments of my career to sit here. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you for being so wonderful and asking me.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.